Gentlemen, the case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in McLaughlin against the United States. Mr. Kavari.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. The issue in this case is whether an unloaded handgun is a dangerous weapon in violation of the Section D of the Federal Bank Robbery Statute, 18 U.S. Code 2113. There are two points that I would like to make. First of all, that an unloaded handgun on the facts of this case is not and should not be a dangerous weapon. Secondly, that even if an unloaded handgun can be a dangerous weapon, it ought not to be determined to be a dangerous weapon by a decision of a court of appeals, but rather should remain a factual question for the fact finder. The facts in this case are extremely concisely stated and are on pages 8 to 10 of the joint appendix. The short of the matter is that Mr. McLaughlin and a co-defendant entered a bank, and while the co-defendant emptied several teller stations of funds, Mr. McLaughlin remained in the lobby area of the bank, pointed a handgun generally at the people in the bank, and told them not to move.
They thought about that gun.
Sir, I think they thought that that gun was probably loaded, and I think there's no argument to be made that they were not in some degree frightened, and there's no argument to be made that they had a duty to examine that gun. The question is, how will we determine for 2113D purposes that the gun was dangerous? Certainly, if the gun was loaded, the gun could inflict the harm that it threatens to inflict. And under the courts that have applied an objective test, that has been the test.
Would a metal club be a dangerous weapon in such an instance?
Justice Marshall, I think that a club could be a dangerous weapon in such an instance. If the person remains in the lobby area of
that
the bank.
That could be?
I think that almost anything.
Well, could a gun be a club?
Well, certainly.
Could a gun be a club?
Yes, certainly a gun could be a club, and probably a metal club at that.
Well, it's dangerous then, isn't it?
Well, I think it's only dangerous, and this is certainly the analysis used by some of the courts. It's only dangerous if there's a threat to use it as a club. If the only threat is to use the gun as a gun, and the gun does not work as a gun, the gun is not dangerous as a gun. Now, the courts that have adopted, like the Fourth Circuit, a presumption that any weapon, loaded or unloaded, used during a bank robbery is, as a matter of law, a dangerous weapon, have certainly reasoned that the fear of the victims, the potential for using the gun as a club, or the potential for third-party response, for example, by police forces, makes the situation dangerous. But should we reason from the situation back to the gun? If we do, then even non-guns would be dangerous weapons. The person who goes into the bank and puts his hand in his pocket, claims that he has a gun, could create the same amount of danger as the person who actually displays a gun. By the reasoning of those courts, a dangerous weapon has been used, even though in one instance no weapon at all has been used. After this court's decision in
I think there you can say there is in fact no weapon or device, so that isn't covered. But certainly the legislative history of this particular language would indicate that the sponsor of it thought it would include fake guns, for example, does it not?
Justice O'Connor, I think in one reading it does. And I think in another reading, which is my reading, of course, that it does not. Certainly the sponsor envisioned fake guns or what were referred to as Indiana six-shooters or bottles of water claimed to be nitroglycerin. Certainly they were included somewhere. The question is, where were they included? One of the congressmen, I think the bill sponsor, says in response to questions about the fake weapons that he does not object to the word device being added, but also thinks these might be covered under Section 2 of the statute, which at the time was bank robbery by trick or fraud. Also, at the end of the legislative history, which is extremely meager, the statement is the suggestion that instrumentalities which could cause fear was rejected as an amendment to the Act. So on one hand, I think, yes, the subjective fear of the victim was sought to be protected by the Act. But on the other hand, the question is how. I think the Act can be read consistently with those courts who have applied an objective standard to amount to the following. If a weapon is used and that weapon is dangerous in itself or can carry out the harm that it threatens, you have a dangerous weapon. If it can't, then you might have bank robbery by trick, you might have assault on the tellers, but you may not have a dangerous weapon. The statute doesn't punish bank robbery with a weapon. It doesn't punish bank robbery with an apparently dangerous weapon. It doesn't punish bank robbery because a dangerous situation is created. It punishes bank robbery during which an assault is committed using a dangerous weapon. If we reason from the assault...
Well, but not, Mr. Kupari, it punishes bank robbery with a dangerous weapon or device if the device or weapon is used in an assault on any person or puts in jeopardy the life of any person, doesn't it?
Yes, sir.
So it really doesn't punish bank robbery with a dangerous weapon.
Well, it punishes an assault or placing in jeopardy during a bank robbery.
Yes.
Yes, sir. In Mr. McLaughlin's case, only the assaultive clause of 2113D is operable.
Yeah. No one claims he put anyone's life in jeopardy with starter pistol, whatever it was.
Well, it was an unloaded handgun, and the claim was not made that he put someone's life in jeopardy.
So, but you don't deny that he technically assaulted someone, do you?
No, he pled guilty to the assault. He pled guilty to the A and B sections of that statute, which prohibit the bank robbery assault and the bank larceny. And we had a bench trial on the D section on the issue of, number one, the unloaded handgun, and number two, the Fourth Circuit's decision, which makes it presumptive guilt if you have any weapon. When this Court decided Simpson in 1978, this Court applied the phrase dangerous weapon to both clauses, the assaultive clause and the putting in jeopardy clause. Much of the case law developed prior to that time, and much of the case law reasons that an assault under A that one could reasonably determine to be an aggravated assault, if there was a weapon used, amounted to a violation of D. But it's unclear whether those courts read the dangerous weapon phrase as modifying the assault. After Simpson, when the courts had to read that, I think what has happened is, so as not to lose the aggravated assault punishment, all of that case law was simply applied to the dangerous weapon in the following two ways. Number one, if there's enough evidence for the jury to conclude the weapon was loaded, it's a dangerous weapon. We don't contest that. Number two, the creation of presumptions of dangerousness by the circuit courts. The Fourth Circuit, the Fifth Circuit, possibly the Tenth and Eleventh Circuits have rules that state a weapon, loaded or unloaded, used during a bank robbery is a dangerous weapon. There's no argument. The effect of that is read in the indictment in this case, which is on page 5 of the joint appendix, where Mr. McLaughlin is not charged with using a dangerous weapon. He's charged with brandishing that weapon, with pointing a firearm at the tellers in the bank. If the jury or if a fact finder concludes a weapon was used, and Mr. McLaughlin admitted one was, he is therefore guilty of using a dangerous weapon without more. I do not think that that is correct, and I do think that that is a violation of Winship, which was decided 16 years ago today.
Would your position be the same
him if he had the gun loaded but with blanks?
No, sir. My position — yes, sir. My position would be the same. I would see no difference between a gun that was loaded with blanks or a gun that was unloaded, or a starter pistol, or a gun that was not loaded but there was ammunition in the person's pocket. If the gun cannot function as the weapon that threatens, it ought not to be a dangerous weapon. If Mr. McLaughlin had approached one of the people in the bank and had struck them with a weapon, or if he had approached someone and grabbed someone and held the weapon in a threatening manner to threaten bludgeoning, then it becomes dangerous as a bludgeon. But that's not here.
May I interrupt? Supposing on these the facts we've got here, but we have a trial, they couldn't prove there were bullets in the gun. They had a chase and the man threw bullets out the window of his car, but you couldn't prove whether they're in the gun or not at the time of the transaction. Who would have the burden, under your view of the law, who would have the burden of proving that they were in the gun?
Well, I think the burden is on the government to prove dangerous
weapons. If the government cannot in fact prove by some evidence, by reasonable doubt, that the bullets were in the gun at the time of the bank robbery, defendants would always win on this.
I don't think that's correct. I think if the government puts forth enough proof for a jury to conclude that the gun must have been loaded, that's sufficient. For example, in this case, if there had been no evidence other than Mr. McLaughlin pointing the handgun, the cases, I think, established that a fact finder, judge or jury, could conclude that gun was loaded and dangerous since there's no evidence to the contrary.
On the other hand, is there any evidence to show that they knew that the government gun was unloaded?
In this case, there is. The government conceded
no,
that...
No, I'm talking about the people.
No,
the
sir.
Bank.
No, there is no evidence to show the people knew the gun was unloaded. And there's no attempt to diminish the fear of the people, and there's no attempt to say that people ought to know the gun is unloaded.
Can you get fear without fear of a deadly weapon?
Sir, I think there is as much fear in the case of an unloaded handgun as there is in a loaded one.
Well, that's what a deadly weapon is.
I don't.
That's why a weapon is deadly, is because it can harm.
I agree, sir, that the weapon is deadly because it can harm.
What
but
size gun was it?
I don't know. All we have in the record is that it was a dark handgun. The weapon is dangerous because it can harm. But if, in fact, it cannot harm, in the manner in which it's used...
Well, but supposing he had bullets in his pocket.
Then the weapon didn't work as a gun.
And if what if he has the safety device on?
Well, Justice O'Connor, I think at some point we have to draw a line. The line I drew was the fact that the gun was loaded. Now, if a fact finder could conclude that the safety device was not, even though it was on, the gun being otherwise operable and loaded, the fact finder could conclude that that didn't matter. That's such a small thing and so easily changed that it did not effectively negate the harm the gun threatened. Then, fine, you can convict someone of using that weapon. But it ought not to be taken from the fact finder as a matter
of law.
Can't
you push a bullet into a six-shooter chamber as easily as you can take off the safety device?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if you can because it certainly has to be opened. It has to be taken out and put in. And I don't think that it's a workable standard simply to say that if the bullets are within a foot of the gun, maybe it's dangerous, maybe it isn't. If they're far away, maybe it's less dangerous. I think we look at the gun, and then we look at the way it's used. If it is used in such a way that it can readily inflict the harm it threatens, then it's used as a dangerous weapon. But if it's used in a manner that cannot inflict the harm threatened, it cannot be seen as a dangerous weapon unless you look just at the fear of the victims, which is certainly a concern.
Do you say it's a charge to the jury as a question of fact, then, in every case?
In every case, the jury or the fact finder should have to make a finding that the weapon was dangerous beyond a reasonable doubt, yes.
You don't mean as a special verdict, but just be charged, although to find that as a fact along with the other facts they have to find.
That's correct, sir. In the Fourth Circuit, that's not what's done, of course. Because of the Bennett decision, if there's a weapon, it is a dangerous weapon. And there is no argument to present to the jury. The fact that in this case, Mr. McLaughlin had an unloaded handgun, no bullets, could not have loaded it, and did not use it in any other way, was meaningless at trial. There was no argument to be made because that was a dangerous weapon once he admitted to the assault using the handgun. I think what...
Is that a firearm is never dangerous until it's loaded.
No, sir, because the firearm could certainly be used as a club. It's not dangerous until it's loaded or until it's used in some way that creates a danger from its being there, other than just the fear.
Well, what if it's loaded, but he doesn't find it necessary to pull the trigger?
Well, then I think it's a dangerous weapon because it can immediately inflict the harm that it threatens.
That's contrary to your earlier definition. Used for the purpose intended, that is, to kill or wound somebody that resists.
Well, I have no trouble reaching the conclusion that a handgun that is loaded and operable is immediately a dangerous weapon and can be found that way by a jury simply on that evidence.
And why isn't it dangerous? Because it can be used as a club?
Because unless there's evidence that it was either — that it was threatened to be used as a club, it wasn't used as a club. We look at someone with a handgun and we say, well, that gun could be used as a club, of course. But if the person uses it in such a way that there's no threat that it's going to be used as a club, should we infer, since it's metal, it could be used as a club? If someone robs a bank with a heavy — carrying a heavy briefcase, should we infer that since it's a heavy briefcase, it could be used as a bludgeon, and therefore it's a dangerous weapon? Once the gun ceases to be used as a gun, what is it? Certainly, it's a heavy piece of metal that could be used as a bludgeon. In this case, there is no evidence that it was used as a bludgeon, was about to be used as a bludgeon, or that any threat was made to use it as a bludgeon. In almost all of the cases that deal with the bludgeon issue, one of two things is present. First of all, it was used as a bludgeon. Even as late as last year in the Wardy case, the Second Circuit finds the gun could be used as a bludgeon. It was used as a bludgeon. And in addition, there was enough evidence from which the fact finder could conclude it was loaded.
May I ask this question? Assume that instead of this case involving a revolver, which apparently it was an automatic weapon like a Colt 45. And let's say there were 10 bullets in the clip, but none had been moved up into the barrel, so it couldn't be fired without making that movement. Would it be loaded?
I think it would be loaded. I think it, even if it isn't loaded, it can be loaded so quickly that the distinction is meaningless. But I think it should be a factual question for the fact finder to hear the evidence of how that gun was at the time of the robbery, to hear testimony if the defendant wants to testify as to why it wasn't loaded, and make a decision.
Well, if there were only one bullet in the cylinder that holds six in a revolver, and that bullet was several cylinders away from the barrel, you'd make the same answer.
I would conclude it was loaded, but I would also want it given to the fact finder to draw the conclusion of dangerousness. In all of the state cases, virtually every state case that is cited for the proposition that an unloaded handgun is a dangerous weapon, there is involved a statute making an unloaded handgun a dangerous weapon.
Have the courts of appeals had occasion to construe the word assault in subsection D? Is it treated as the common law definition of assault, as simply pointing, a weapon at someone is an assault?
I'm going to answer by saying yes, but I'm going to say that the language in the cases is not as simple as the yes answer. The Beasley case, which Judge McCree's dissent worked its way into this Court's decision in Simpson that the dangerous weapon phrase applies to the assault clause, discusses common law assault, discusses what an assault is under A, and says, as does Bradley and many of the other cases that on my side of the fence, you need more than an assault to get from A to D. You need a sufficiently aggravating factor that takes the case out of a violation of A, taking the money by intimidation, and getting it into D, using a dangerous weapon.
It's hard to imagine intimidation really without a technical common law assault, isn't it?
Well, it is, but it's not hard to imagine it without a gun.
Oh, yeah.
I think you do need the common law assault. But when do you get from the assault to the dangerous weapon is our question.
What about intent? Suppose he'd come in there and said, this is an unloaded gun, and I'm going to rob you. What would have happened?
Certainly there's a violation
of that. Outside him being shot. What else would happen?
If the man comes in and says, this gun is unloaded and I'm going to rob you, he'll probably be caught. Yeah. In addition, he may well get money from the tellers who might be frightened anyway. He also could,
You like to believe that?
That he might get money?
Yeah.
Well, based on some of the people I've represented, yes, I do. I also know they get caught outside the bank.
box.
Thank you.
You may resume your argument, counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the Court. I would like to discuss briefly the second point that I wanted to discuss today, which is the Fourth Circuit's decision in the Bennett case that establishes that a weapon, loaded or unloaded, used during a bank robbery is a dangerous weapon. We think that that is a violation of this Court's decision in Winship because it takes from the government the burden of having to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that a weapon used in an assault during a bank robbery is a dangerous weapon as a matter of fact.
That assumes, Mr. Kribay, that Congress intended it to be a question of fact in each case.
It does indeed. If Congress were to pass a definitional statute saying unloaded handguns are dangerous weapons within the purview of this act, we're not here. But that's not there. It's there in other firearms legislation. It's there in 924, but it's not there in 2113. And because it's not there, the Fourth Circuit shouldn't put it there. That should leave the question a question of fact for the fact finder and not foreclose the fact finder from considering all the circumstances involved in making a decision whether that weapon was dangerous.
But suppose the gun were loaded, either a magazine and an automatic or in a cylinder revolver, but there was no firing pin.
If there's no firing pin and the weapon cannot function as a weapon, then I don't think it's dangerous as a weapon.
You mean if it can't function as a firearm?
As a firearm. If it can't function as the weapon it appears to be, unless it is used as a different weapon. If a threat is made to bludgeon, then we can determine it from the facts regarding its use as a bludgeon.
Let's take it one step further. The firing pin is defective, but nobody knows that. That happens sometimes. What about that?
My position would be, first of all, that weapon that could not operate as the handgun, without more, that's all it's used as, is not a dangerous weapon. Just like white powdery substances that test out to be baking soda are not heroin. If the Court doesn't want to go that far, and the Court wants to leave that question about dangerousness for the fact finder, that also is an acceptable position. Either of those positions cut against the Fourth Circuit's decision in Bennett.
Well, your position would mean that before the government would present the case, they'd have to test the gun and see whether the firing pin was really working.
It might mean that. It certainly would mean the government could not sustain or might not be able to sustain a verdict of guilty given evidence that the person who used the gun knew the firing pin was defective. In fact, the person who used the gun may have caused damage to the firing pin just so no one would be injured by use of the gun.
Well, there could be worse cases than that for the government. Supposing that in your hypothetical, not the hypothetical case, but the case of your client, except that the gun is loaded but is never fired, and the gun simply disappears. The guy gets away for a while, the government never recovers the gun. If the burden is on the government to prove that it was loaded, it probably won't be able to do it.
Well, Justice Rehnquist, the cases are clear, and once again, we do not dispute the cases that say, from circumstantial evidence, the jury would be warranted in inferring the gun was loaded. If the defendant testifies that at the time of the crime the gun was not loaded, and there's the testimony from the victims, bystanders, or whatever, there would be a question of fact.
But the testimony of the bystanders, all they can testify is what happened here. They were afraid because the guy had a gun. They wouldn't have seen any bullets fired from him.
That's true, but they can testify to what the person who perpetrated the robbery did with the gun.
Well, he's going to tell them it's loaded.
He's going to tell them that it's unloaded. Well, the bystander is going to say that I saw a gun. The defendant's going to say it was not loaded.
Yes, but the defendant at the time of the bank robbery isn't going to tell the bystanders it's not loaded.
Of course not, which is why, at the very least, we have a factual question for the fact finder. Do we believe the testimony of the defendant? Do we take the testimony of everyone else and draw the inference that the gun was loaded?
Well, so supposing that you have a trial of this issue, and the defendant either says nothing or takes the stance as it wasn't loaded, The bystanders say he said he was going to shoot us if we moved. None of them can testify to the fact that it was in fact loaded. Is that enough to even take the case to the jury under the reasonable doubt standard?
My position would be that if the evidence is conclusive that the weapon was not loaded, no. But if it's
well, no,
a question of fact...
Just the hypothesis I gave you. Could the judge charge the jury as to find that they could find there was a dangerous weapon with only the testimony from the bystanders that the fellow brandished a gun at them?
I think that the matter could be submitted to the jury with the instruction that from the evidence you have heard, if you disbelieve the defendant and believe the other testimony, you would be allowed to infer that the weapon was loaded and operable. Nevertheless, you must find beyond a reasonable doubt that it was a dangerous weapon.
This case was tried before a judge, wasn't it?
Yes, sir, it was.
And it wasn't a jury.
It was not. There was no jury.
Well, what is there to tell me that the judge didn't decide that it was a dangerous weapon?
I think the Bennett decision, which is clear in its instructions that the weapon is dangerous, period.
But did the judge decide that in order to convict him?
It does not appear from the record that the judge said...
Well, how else could the judge convict him other than that?
I don't think anyway. I think the judge was bound by the Fourth Circuit decision in Bennett, and I think that it's not going outside the record to say that at the beginning of the proceeding, it's put on the record why we were having a guilty plea as to some counts.
But you've been arguing that it's up to the trier of fact. Well, the judge was the trier of fact.
But in this case...
Wasn't he in this case?
He is the trier of fact in this case, but because of the Bennett decision, there was no factual matter for him to decide. It was taken away by the Bennett decision.
Did he say that?
He did not say that in those words.
Well, how do you know he did?
We know he did that because it is explained in the record that the purpose of the proceeding was to test
Bennett. Where in the record?
At the beginning of the, in the joint appendix, at the beginning of the trial proceeding, which is on page 7 and 8, and I think it's inferred again on page 11 at the top, the reason we are here is to preserve the issue of law that under Bennett the government has no burden of proof at all concerning the fact the gun be loaded or not. That under the Bennett decision...
Well, then I get to my next question. You answered the Chief Justice's point about the firing pin. Suppose the firing pin was okay, but the gun just jammed when he shot it. He shot at one of the people and the gun jammed. Would that be under the statute?
Well, I would prefer, sir, that... I would prefer that in that case there is a dangerous weapon. Fortuitously, it didn't work, just as if there were bulletproof glass that was up and the bullet didn't penetrate the glass. That does not render the weapon not a dangerous weapon. I don't think the question
is... Well, was that weapon any more dangerous than this one?
The weapon that jams when used?
Yes.
I think that there, that weapon is much more dangerous than a weapon that can't work at all.
Why?
Because the weapon that jams when used is nevertheless a weapon which, when exhibited, was a weapon that could actually inflict the harm threatened until the fortuitous accident of jamming, whereas an unloaded weapon cannot inflict the harm threatened at all. Unless it's used in a different manner, and then you look at the manner in which it was used to determine its dangerous.
I'm looking at the manner in which it was used for the purpose of frightening the people. Do you agree to that?
I agree.
And to scaring them.
I agree.
But you say it's not a dangerous weapon.
I say that that's a violation of Section A, the assault, that does not also amount to a violation of Section
A. Well, what was the purpose of the assault?
The purpose of the assault was to take money by intimidation.
Well, isn't that what happened?
That's exactly what happened, which is why Mr. McLaughlin pled guilty to taking money by intimidation. But it is if that is also a violation of Section D, then there's no distinction between A and D. Taking money by intimidation, the source of the intimidation being an unloaded weapon, is also taking money by a dangerous weapon. And I don't think that that's warranted on the wording of the statute or on the history of the statute. And for the Fourth Circuit to establish that as a matter of law, I think is a violation of Winship. If Congress wants to make that change, it can make that change. If the government had put 924C at the bottom of the indictment instead of 2113D, we wouldn't be here. The effect of Bennett is to allow the government to charge a use of a dangerous weapon and convict for use of a dangerous weapon merely on the display of a weapon, loaded or unloaded. Absent the congressional definition to that effect, that action in Bennett is wrong. Unless there are further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Mr. Wright.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the government's position is that an unloaded gun is a dangerous weapon or device for two different reasons. Our primary argument is that brandishing a gun during a bank robbery is likely to provoke violence. Many courts have recognized that the display of an apparently deadly weapon in the highly charged atmosphere of a bank during a robbery may lead to retaliation, so that harm could occur in any of a number of different ways. As one of the many state courts that has held that an unloaded gun is a dangerous weapon stated, danger invites rescue and self-help. The Fourth Circuit noted in the Bennett case that frightened bystanders, security guards, or passing police officers might take precipitous action that could lead to harm to people in the bank at the time of the robbery. It is, therefore, sensible to punish robbers who display guns more severely than robbers who do not, and we think that that was Congress's goal in enacting Section 2113D.
Mr. Wright, you take the position then that a toy gun would also be a dangerous weapon.
Whether a toy gun is a dangerous weapon.
One that looks exactly like a real gun.
That's right. It depends on what it looks like. If it looks just like a dangerous weapon, just like a real gun, then we would contend that it is a dangerous weapon or device under the statute because its display is likely to provoke retaliation. If it does not look like a real gun, we would say it does not, and there might be a question of fact in such a case for a jury, unlike this case where it's uncontested that this was a real handgun.
What if all the bystanders were nearsighted, so they thought that the gun really was threatening, when in fact, if you'd had good eyesight, you would have realized it was a toy gun?
I had not considered that possibility, Justice Rehnquist.
Perhaps you devoted yourself to a more important question.
I would contend that that would be a factual question for the jury, and the nearsightedness of the bystanders would be relevant in such a case.
What about a toothbrush in the pocket of a coat, sticking it out and making it look like a...
We do not think that... The toothbrush is similar to the finger in the pocket or the appearance.
No, I've got a weapon now. With a finger, I don't.
I don't think a toothbrush is a weapon, although it certainly is a device.
Well, but a toy gun isn't a weapon. Say it's made out of paper mache.
Well, it's certainly a device, and we think that the display of a toy gun, assuming it looks somewhat real, would make it a dangerous device.
Well, what if you did the toy gun, but you didn't take it out of your pocket, but still manifested the likelihood that there was a real gun in there? I think your theory would apply.
We contend that if the gun is never brandished, that is not the use of a weapon to assault anyone within the meaning of the statute, and we do not contend that it applies, that the additional punishment of Section 2113D would be warranted in such a case. That's one of the many cases that where we think that subsection A would apply, but not subsection D.
Toy gun's enough, provided they see the toy gun.
We think, under our view, we believe that the brandishing of the weapon is quite important. We think that that is what is likely to provoke retaliation. We think that a finger in the pocket or a toothbrush in the pocket simply is not nearly as likely to provoke retaliation. Bystanders may well not notice the fact that a robbery is going on at all, as was the case in the Brown case, which we cited in our brief.
Well, to qualify under D, you have to show an assault, don't you, when you're talking about an unloaded...
You have to use the weapon to assault someone.
Yes.
That's right. Petitioner agrees in his brief at page 12 that displaying an unloaded gun during a robbery is dangerous, but argues that Congress did not intend to punish bank robbers who create dangerous situations because Section 2113D refers only to dangerous weapons or devices. We disagree. It seems obvious that Congress enacted that aggravated bank robbery provision in order to give enhanced punishment to robbers who act in ways that are more likely to create serious injury. Furthermore, petitioner neglects that Section 2113D refers to devices as well as to weapons. As legislative history shows, Congress was concerned with the psychological effect of the display of a weapon on the minds of people in the bank at the time of the robbery and added the word device in order to make it clear. As a secondary argument, we contend that an unloaded gun is a dangerous weapon or device within the meaning of the statute because it may be used as a bludgeon, as a California court noted more than 50 years ago, and as a number of courts have noted since. The display of a gun, whether loaded or unloaded, is a threat to inflict injury by means of beating someone, and a robber displaying a gun is capable of carrying out that threat. To make our position clear, I'd like to consider one other example raised by Justice Marshall. He asked whether a metal club is a dangerous weapon. We think that clearly it is. We also think it's worth noting that a metal club is not nearly as useful as a weapon, even if just used as a bludgeon, as an unloaded gun is. An unloaded gun, when pointed at someone, will normally cause them to remain stationary so that the robber may walk over and hit them with the gun. Brandishing a metal club, in contrast, is much less likely to cause a robber to remain stationary. And so that's why we think robbers use unloaded guns rather than metal clubs in robbing banks. The legislative history confirms that Congress intended Section 2113D to prescribe the use of weapons having the apparent capability of inflicting harm. The words "or device" were added to that part of the bill that became subsection D after an enlightening floor exchange. Representative Blanton feared that that courts would not construe the phrase "dangerous weapon" broadly to cover devices such as fake bombs and fake guns, and he proposed amending the provision to add the word "device" in order to make clear that it ought to apply in such circumstances. In fact, as an example of the sort of instrument that he thought ought to be covered, he referred to, quote, "one of those new kind of Indiana six-shooters carved out of a piece of wood with a pocket knife," unquote. He also noted that a bottle of water asserted to be nitroglycerin would have the same effect psychologically on the minds of the people in the bank as a real bomb. This legislative history, which to our knowledge has not been cited by any court, including the district court in California that ruled contrary to us on this question, and we think that it clearly shows that Congress intended that an unloaded gun would be a dangerous weapon because it has the apparent capability of inflicting harm.
Well, but then it seems to me that the legislative history cuts a little bit against that, because if Congress thought that an unloaded gun would be a dangerous weapon, presumably would have thought the Indiana six-shooter would also be a dangerous weapon, don't you think?
I think that that's right. And
then why did they feel it necessary to add the word device?
Representative Blanton explained, as you appear to be looking at the reply brief, Justice Rehnquist.
Oh, that's the wrong source.
No, the exchange covered there is Representative Blanton has proposed the addition of the word "and device." And as an example, he says that it would cover something like an Indiana six-shooter. Representative Sumners then says, I think that that's already covered by Section 2, which is now subsection B, the bank larceny provision. But the point is, Representative Blanton wanted subsection D to cover that situation, and he went on to propose the amendment, which was passed by Congress, that added the words "or device" to what is now subsection D, so that subsection D applies in cases of fake guns and fake bombs, and we submit unloaded guns as well.
Then is the government's basic argument here that although the unloaded gun is not a dangerous weapon, it is a dangerous device?
Well, we would argue that an unloaded gun is a dangerous weapon, as 8 of the 9 state courts
consider. Then you don't need that legislative history, do you?
Well, no, that's right, we don't. But we think that the addition of the words "or device" accompanied by the explanatory exchange between Representative Blanton and the other congressman, makes quite clear that Congress — Representative Blanton proposed to add those words in case courts did not think that dangerous weapon would apply in cases such as fake bombs and fake guns. To make it perfectly clear, he added the words or device to the statute. We would contend that an unloaded gun is a dangerous weapon without that addition. With that addition, it seems to us beyond doubt that an unloaded gun is a dangerous weapon.
May I ask you on your bludgeon theory, your second of your two principal submissions, I've seen in the movies at least sometimes very tiny things that are supposed to hide them in their sock or something, and it's a gun, but it'll shoot and kill somebody with a bullet. Would that be a bludgeon in your view? Just no matter how small the firing...
It seems to us that that may well present a fact question if the court ruled that whether an unloaded gun was a dangerous weapon depended only on its use as a bludgeon.
But if that's the case, what about the record in this case? All we know is it was a, quote, handgun, unquote, don't we?
That is correct. There's been no evidence whatever that it's not...
So we don't know whether it's big enough to be a bludgeon or not. So I wonder if there's anything in the record to support your second theory, at least beyond a reason. Could the judge find beyond a reasonable doubt that you've got a quote, bludgeon, unquote, in this case?
Well, we don't know exactly why the judge ruled it was a dangerous weapon.
Well, isn't it correct, as your opponent suggests in the colloquy, that they thought the Fourth Circuit law was that a gun capable of being fired is a dangerous weapon even if there are no bullets in it?
That's so correct. And the companion case, Johnson, which the court is holding, it was a jury trial, and attached to the petition, there are the jury instructions that were given in that case, which focus on the apparent capability of the weapon to inflict harm, which I presume the judge here felt was the test, although he did not state it.
Nothing in the record that shows whether this gun is capable of being used as a bludgeon or not. That's all I'm trying to say.
I think that is correct. I would add that it seemed to me that it would only be the quite unusual weapon, of which we have no evidence in the record that this weapon was the sort that would not be capable of being used as a bludgeon. And all we know is that the judge here decided it was a dangerous weapon, so perhaps he felt it was capable of being used.
Yeah, but he decided on the basis of precisely the same written material that's in front of us. He never saw the thing, or as I understand it, he just acted on the submission of the government as to what they would prove if they had to go to trial. It was an offer of proof.
I think that's right, yes. Contrary to petitioner's argument and the argument accepted by the district court in California that ruled contrary to the government, interpretation of the aggravated bank robbery provision to cover unloaded guns and fake weapons does not render redundant Section 2113A, the straight bank robbery provision. Aggravated bank robbery, which is punishable by 5 more years imprisonment than straight bank robbery, differs from straight bank robbery in that a dangerous weapon or device must be used to assault someone during the course of a robbery. It is, of course, possible to rob a bank without the use of any weapon at all. Robbers frequently pass notes to bank tellers demanding money, sometimes claiming that they have a weapon, when in fact they do not have any weapon at all. Second, robbers sometimes grab bank employees and threaten to beat or strangle them if they're not given money. And, of course, that doesn't involve the use of a weapon or device either. And, as I mentioned earlier, it may be later determined that a bank robber was actually carrying a weapon during a bank robbery, but he never displayed it during the robbery. That does not seem to us to be the use of a weapon to assault anyone, so that while subsection A applies, subsection D does not. In short, there are a number of cases in which subsection A applies and D does not, and so interpreting subsection D to apply in the case of the use of an unloaded gun does not render subsection A superfluous. In that connection, it's worth noting that a number of state courts and state legislatures have construed their first-degree robbery statutes to cover the use of unloaded guns. that has not rendered their second-degree robbery statutes superfluous. The fact that the state courts have unanimously construed the phrase dangerous weapon, or nearly unanimously, there was one case that went the other way, supports our contention that such an interpretation comports with the plain meaning of the phrase. And as I mentioned before, even in the absence of the strong legislative history in this case, we would so contend. Petitioner has suggested in his reply brief that the eight state cases we have cited are not relevant because the evidence in those cases showed that the gun was used as a bludgeon, or because the state statute in effect defined an unloaded gun as a dangerous weapon, or because there was evidence that the gun might have been loaded. In one of the eight cases we cited, the Nichols case from Iowa, the court did in fact rely on a definitional statute. In two of the cases, the Aranda case from California and the Montana case from New Mexico, there was some evidence showing that the gun may have been loaded, but we cited those cases because the courts in those cases made absolutely clear that whether or not the gun was loaded made no difference in their holding. In the other five cases, there was no evidence that the gun was used as a bludgeon. There was no reliance upon any definitional statute. And there was no evidence even tending to show that the gun was unloaded. And the courts nevertheless held that the unloaded gun was a dangerous weapon when used in a robbery. The experience in the one state where a court held that an unloaded gun is not a dangerous weapon when used in a robbery is also instructive. The legislature in that state, Wisconsin, subsequently amended the state statute so that it now applies to, quote, any article used or fashioned in a manner to lead the victim reasonably to believe that it is a dangerous weapon. As we noted in our brief, 15 other states have statutes that on their face appear to apply in the case of an unloaded gun. To be sure, as petitioners pointed out, those reflect legislative judgments. But we cite them to show that it is sensible to construe robbery statutes to punish robbers who brandish weapons more severely than robbers who do not. It appears that the vast majority of the states that have considered that question have, like Congress, come to that conclusion. In summary, the United States contends that an unloaded gun is a dangerous weapon or device within the meaning of Section 2113D because its display is likely to provoke retaliation. In addition, an unloaded gun is a dangerous weapon or device because it can be used as a bludgeon to inflict harm. The addition of the words or device to that part of the statute that became Section 2113D makes that clear. If an Indiana six-shooter is a dangerous weapon, then a real gun that is not loaded surely is. Our construction of subsection D does not render subsection A redundant any more than the many state statutes and cases holding that an unloaded gun is a dangerous weapon under first-degree robbery statutes makes the second-degree statutes superfluous. And as the overwhelming weight of authority in favor of our view shows, this position makes sense. It makes sense to punish a robber who brandishes a weapon more severely than one who does not, whether or not the robber's gun was loaded. Thank you.
You have 1 minute remaining,
counsel. Thank you, sir. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court, I agree that it makes sense to punish robbers who display guns. That's why we have 924C, which punishes robbers who display guns. 2113D punishes the use of a dangerous weapon during an assault committed during a bank robbery or used to place life in jeopardy during a bank robbery. This Court referred to the legislative history of 2113D in its footnote in Simpson, and it explained that dangerous weapon applies equally to the assault of and the jeopardy clauses, and it notes that the 2113D was enacted to fight gangsterism in the 1930s. What was clearly in the mind of Congress was to punish people who use weapons that can shoot people, that can explode, and that weapons that look like them are not punished as devices, but are punished under the fear section of that statute. The Wisconsin experience is instructive. What should happen is that Congress should determine that 2113D encompasses unloaded handguns, not the Fourth Circuit. What the Fourth Circuit has done is foreclose the question entirely. There is a factual question to be decided during a trial, and it should be decided there, during the trial. What the government would have this court do is gut dangerousness from the statute. Thank you very much.
Good gentlemen, the case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in...